This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
This is always a confident show, particularly when we are getting ready for the U.S. Open to tee off, and we can give you last-minute gambling tips with our guy, John Campbell. We welcome him in now. He's at Johnny Oddshark on Twitter. John Campbell, appreciate you joining us. What do you like here as you look at some of the gambling options available to everyone out there in the minutes before the U.S. Open officially begins on Thursday?
Well, one guy I think you absolutely have to put a little bit on is Jason Day, and he's around 18 to 1. So he just had an incredible season here, and I think this is a course where you have to be able to do everything well, especially be a great iron player. I think that second shot's going to be a big deal here. But he's also on pace for the best strokes gained putting season ever, and as we know, those 5 to 10 footer putts are always huge in the U.S. Open, and he's so good at those. So he's my pick to win. I think he's a guy you have to put a little something on. And then from there, I think you're looking for those great iron players and those great guys around the green. There are a few guys around there looking at longer shots, like Mickelson at 33-1, Paul Casey's 50-1, and then getting into some longer shots, Jimmy Walker is 100-1, great iron player, great putter, and Zach Johnson, not long, and I know a lot of people are looking at long hitters for this course, but he can do everything well, and at 125-1, he's the guy I'm going to put a little sprinkle on as well.
Dustin Johnson, Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, Justin Rose, Jason Day, Jordan Spieth, Tiger Woods, Ricky Fowler, Brooks Koepka off the top are the guys who are favored, but none of those guys are much different than 8-1 or fewer. How do you bet futures odds going into a golf tournament? You just mentioned sprinkling some money on a variety of golfers. How many people would you say out there that gamblers should put money on, and how should you spend that money? In other words, let's say you've got $500 that you want to put down on futures odds to make this golf tournament more entertaining for you. How would you suggest distributing that money? You know, in other words, like just kind of the bankroll, how do you manage to make the decisions of who to put money on?
Yeah, for golf, I play almost exclusively futures. I used to play more three balls and things like that and play round to round, because I think there's some value. You get horses for courses, and you can find great value there. With golf, I would put most of it as futures money and look to play. I'd probably play the first half of that all on futures, take 5, 6, 7, 8 players, something like that. And then golf is such a great in-tournament futures options event. And as the rounds go on, we see huge swings in futures odds as well. So come the third day, come going into the fourth day, you really just need a guy who's on the first page of the leaderboard with decent odds, and you're in a really good hedge situation to look at some other guys that way. So I love betting golf that way. Where this is a course where it's U.S. Open, it's kind of a one-off with Shinnecock Hills. I'm not looking at guys who can specialize in this course. So it is mostly futures here. With an event like the World Cup, I'd say about 30% on futures, and then I'd look to play the rest game to game.
We are talking to John Campbell. You can follow him at Johnny Oddshark on Twitter. Big news that came out yesterday live on the show. The U.S., Canada, where you are, and Mexico will be hosting the 2026 World Cup. The big thing here when I think about in terms of gambling is there will be a ton of United States states where gambling is legal by the time 2026 comes around. 2018, only a handful so far. How do you gamble on the 2018 World Cup? Where's the value when you look at it right now?
Well, it depends on what book you look at in terms of value and where most of the money is going. At BetOnline, for example, Brazil is the overwhelming pick right now with 28% of futures bets on Brazil. But you go to Bovada, and Germany is getting 24% of the futures action there. So there's a few teams that are jammed up at the top. We've got Brazil, Germany, Spain, all 7-1 or less. Same with France. Then Argentina, Belgium, and England, always popular picks in terms of futures. So take your pick out of there. The longer shots, Croatia is a team I kind of like, 33-1 that I'm looking at there, but those usual suspects are getting all the early action.
What about instant replay now being involved? In theory, this would help in the over-unders of goals, because usually I think it's goals that shouldn't exist that have been getting overruled or not recognized. Now that instant replay is a real factor, does that change the way you handicap any of these games?
Not really. I think we saw a goal yesterday or a couple days ago where Poland had a goal that crossed the goal line on a free kick, and the play went on and they reviewed it. So we might see that happen a couple of times throughout a tournament where they need to review a game. So I don't think there's a big difference in the way you handicap this, but I think changes are coming. I think eventually we'll start to see instant replay used for things like diving, and that will create a change in the way that we handicap games, but not so much for this tournament.
We're talking to John Campbell. You can find him on Twitter at Johnny Oddshark. The other big story that continues to evolve, and this is one where I think the offshores almost can set the narrative, it is, where's LeBron James going to play next? And there's been a lot of money coming in on the Lakers. How accurate do you think these offshore markets are when it comes to projecting free agency? I know, for instance, that with the number one overall draft pick, there was no money on Baker Mayfield, and then suddenly all the money came roaring in on Baker Mayfield. When there's only a couple of guys that are making a decision, is this accurate, inaccurate? Would you use the gauge of the Lakers becoming the favorite as any kind of harbinger potentially that the Lakers are going to get LeBron?
Yeah, I used to say that these were really accurate and a really good indicator, but you mentioned the Baker Mayfield one where books didn't see that coming. And these odds for LeBron have flip-flopped like crazy. The Sixers at one point were the favorite at +150. They moved to 4-1. The Cavs were also the favorite at one point for his next team at +175. They're 7-1. Rockets have gone up to 6-1 after being close to the favorites here. So the Lakers are now seeing -110 money. Why I think this might be accurate here is because we've also seen the changes reflect in the futures odds. And the Lakers, also in Las Vegas, and the Lakers have moved up to 16-1 favorites to win the NBA championship. And there's no way they should be there if books aren't anticipating LeBron going there next year. Same with the Cavs. The Cavs are 25-1, and that price is just way too generous if LeBron is going to be there next year. So in this case, I think we are starting to see them be a little more accurate here because of the reflection in futures odds.
What else is out there that you're paying attention to in the gambling universe? We haven't really talked about this a ton, but Delaware now has gambling in the United States. New Jersey has signed the bill to allow it. Mississippi is expected to have it soon. Connecticut, West Virginia. There are a lot of states that are all making movements to allow sports gambling. How much attention are you paying to individual state decisions with what you do?
I always keep an eye on it. I've been interested in this story since it started and followed it really closely. So I'm interested to see how quickly states are moving on this, and they don't want to be left behind. So I'm keeping an eye on it. I think it's interesting. I think Delaware coming out first surprised a few people. That was one I talked about on my podcast, that they might actually be the first state. So it's a little bit of a race, how important and just the cultural sort of beliefs, I guess, in betting and that sort of thing, how much they can stomach it early on. But I think we're going to just see the dominoes tumble here, and state after state will become legal, and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. We're talking to John Campbell at Johnny Oddshark. For people who are out there right now, give us your U.S. Open picks again, because, again, we are at Shinnecock Hills getting ready for the U.S. Open to officially begin. Who do you like? Who are you putting money on?
Yeah, it's Jason Day is one I love. He's probably my favorite pick. Justin Rose, another guy, 16-1. I'm going to be there. And in terms of longer shots, Mickelson, Casey, Jimmy Walker, Zach Johnson, and Louis Oosthuizen is another one I really like.
Outstanding stuff. As always, I will give you guys all of my gambling picks at the end of hour one for the futures picks right before they tee off. I appreciate the time, John Campbell, and we will talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Clay. Enjoy the U.S. Open.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We bring in now John Morosi. What's going on, John? How are you? And what'd you think of the fracas at the plate last night?
Well, Clay, good morning. Number one, I would say that Matt Kemp was correct in his comments after the game, in which he said that really he didn't have much of a lane to go to. He was the play was being blocked, and so I think from that standpoint, it was not a dirty play on Kemp's part. It sounds as though Robinson Chirinos made the point that in Robinson's opinion, that there was a bit of a nudge or a sort of a shoulder a tossing in there that after things were done, after the play itself, as Matt was getting up, that made him upset, and that's what sparked the shoving and of course the benches clearing situation. So I think interestingly, it does not appear that it is also the opinion of the umpiring crew that there was actually no infraction wrong with Matt either going into Chirinos as he did or the fact that Chirinos was blocking the plate. So it seems like it was all the sort of what happened afterward that was why the players were ejected, and actually both were behaving within the rules while the play was still going on.
We thought we maybe had solved some of the issues with home plate collisions in the wake of obviously major injuries there. And look, this is something that goes all the way back to Ray Fosse, Pete Rose, everything associated with the history of baseball and how you exactly allow the catcher to protect or not protect the plate. Is this something you think has gotten better? Are we more cognizant of it when stories like this happen? Or is this kind of a blip on the radar that isn't necessarily reflective of a larger tension in the game?
I think, Clay, that in general we're in a pretty good spot on home plate collisions. I think MLB has communicated the rule quite well. I thought it was, to me, I was a little disappointed to read that Matt didn't really know what the rule was at the time of the collision. It's obviously been this way for a number of years now, and as a veteran player, he should know the rules. I think fortunately he acted within them anyway, so that's really not that much of a problem. But I think in general, Clay, that we've seen such a move toward players sliding. I realize we saw the slide recently with Anthony Rizzo, who appeared to go out of the baseline to try to take out a catcher who's from a standpoint of his ability to turn a double play on that ball a while ago. I think it was a couple weeks ago. But I think in general, the base runners have just moved to a spot where they are programmed to not collide with the catcher at home plate. They are by and large deciding to slide and do so in a relatively safe manner. And I think, Clay, that's actually why Chirinos reacted the way that he did yesterday, because it happens so infrequently now that there is something of a collision that when it does happen, catchers are caught off guard a little bit. They are really not expecting contact, even though in the case of last night, if you are in the baseline and not giving the runner any sort of lane to slide, you probably should expect contact. So I think that but the contact has become so rare for a variety of reasons that catchers are now not expecting it, and I think that's what happens last night when maybe you've got a catcher who's not expecting it or is not used to it, and all of a sudden takes offense or the base runner has a little bit of confusion or indecision. That's when you have incidents like what we saw last night in Los Angeles.
There's a cool video. I don't know. I bet you have seen it from a 2016, I believe it was a Dodgers-Mets game, where Noah Syndergaard threw behind Chase Utley and immediately got ejected, and then Terry Collins came out of the dugout for the Mets and just went at it with the umpires. Have you seen that video?
Yes, I believe that was following the slide that Utley had against the Mets in the playoffs. So yes, I'm pretty sure I've seen that. Yes.
Yeah, I mean the video just went viral, and you could hear everything that the manager was saying. And the reason why I brought it up is I do wonder you know, like there's lots of talk about ways to get fans engaged and everything else, and so much about baseball and its unwritten rules and everything else associated with it. As someone who covers baseball, do you wish sometimes that we were privy to more of the conversations that take place during the game than we are? I know they do a mic'd up feature every now and then. Certainly it's been popular over the years with Monday Night Football. But the number of people who absolutely loved watching that video and kind of getting a behind-the-scenes peek at what really is going on. I mean, I know people can lip-read sometimes. Is that something that could bring in, you know, like drama seems to sell? And so does authenticity. Is that something that is worth experimenting a little bit with baseball, or you think that's crazy?
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think live mics we're not going to see just because of, I think, first and foremost, I'm sure are still things said in a baseball field that that everybody involved would rather not have it be broadcast to, especially young people. There's still some pretty tough language out there on the field as people are competing, but I do think that a couple things. Number one, when we hear things like that in the video that you're describing with Collins, we do learn things, and I think that the things that are maybe mysterious about the game become a little bit less so once you see them. I also think that in this day and age, that so much of our game and frankly our society is out there in the open, and whether it's due to social media or traditional media, whatever it ends up being, there are just fewer things that shock us. I think from the standpoint of our tolerance and ability to stomach, whether it's coarse language or comments that are maybe not quite as by the book as we're used to hearing from years gone by. And I do think that on everybody's part, it's, I think our ability to be offended by things has been I think lessened a little bit. So I think actually getting the information out there and getting the video out there of a conversation between a manager and an umpire or a player and an umpire, I don't think that it really in many cases would do much damage to the people involved. I think we would take it as a sign of authenticity as opposed to being offended by it. And I do think that we could all stand to have more of those moments in the game where we're allowed to sort of drop in on a conversation, and I hope that we see that happen more often. And I do think, to be candid, that Fox has done a very good job, especially in the All-Star game, which is a game that doesn't quote-unquote count in the way that the other games do, like in the playoffs or other regular season games, that I think last year you saw live mics during the game itself, and George Springer with his memorable interview. I think we're seeing more of that as it's warranted, and I think the All-Star game is a really nice avenue for that to happen.
We're talking to John Morosi. Go follow him on Twitter at JonMorosi. We join him every single Thursday in hour two. Shohei Ohtani seemed like he was going to be an incredible story for Major League Baseball. I feel like many people would have started to pay attention to him even more, certainly, during the summer, now that the NBA, the NHL are over, you have everybody kind of turning the page and paying attention to this in theory. And then disaster with the injury. How severe is this? How long is he going to be gone? What does this mean for his future? What do we know about Ohtani?
Well, Clay, I think we'll know more in a couple weeks. The Angels have said they really want to take some time to reevaluate the imaging and how Shohei feels in really a couple weeks' time after having that platelet-rich plasma injection last week to try to stimulate some recovery in that the elbow and the UCL. So he's been diagnosed with a grade 2 sprain, not a strain, but a sprain, which can mean some very ominous things for Tommy John surgery, but not necessarily. And it's important to point out that he's been pitching with this for a while. The reason why he had the elbow looked at was that he had a blister problem that precipitated the elbow exam. So I think, and I was told this week and reported it, Clay, that the Angels are somewhat cautiously optimistic here that he is going to play again this season. We just don't know if it's going to be as a pitcher and a hitter or a hitter only. If the PRP, the platelet-rich plasma injection, doesn't really yield a lot of recovery from a standpoint of the elbow as a pitcher, I still think we could see him playing as a designated hitter during the course of the balance of the season, and then they can figure out if during the wintertime they can maybe address the elbow with surgery at that point in time if need be. But I think there's a lot of reasons to believe the Angels are going to find a way to try to work this out and have him be a hitter at the very least, because clearly, based on the way things look for them in the last few days in Seattle, they really need Shohei Ohtani, probably now more than ever.
Are the Yankees and the Red Sox the two best teams in Major League Baseball?
It's a great question. I think that, to me, Clay, I still believe on their best day, the Astros are still the best team because their rotation is just that dominant. The Yankees now have two of their starting pitchers from opening day on the DL, Masahiro Tanaka and Jordan Montgomery on the DL. The Red Sox, I think, are a little bit more of a complete team than the Yankees are even. But I think the Astros, when they're at their best, are better than both of them. Their rotation is just that dominant. So I would say right now my enduring pick is the Astros are still the best team, even though the record doesn't say so, and then the Red Sox, and then the Yankees. And the Mariners are a great story. The Mariners, they've got the longest playoff drought. Now the Buffalo Bills made the playoffs. They've got the longest playoff drought in major North American pro sports, going back to 2001 when they won 116 games, and then, of course, lost to the Yankees in the ALCS. So the Mariners, the way they're playing right now, they're a great story, and I think they're really re-engaging the great city of Seattle in baseball and their love for it, which I think is a great thing for the game.
Outstanding stuff as always. I know you have much to get to today. I appreciate you joining us so early in the morning, John Morosi.
Clay, my pleasure. Have a great rest of the week, my friend, and we'll talk to you soon. All the best to your family as always.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We bring in now our guest. He has played this course many times, I'm sure, over his time at here on the course in years and years past. Peter Jacobson, seven-time PGA winner, won the 2004 U.S. Senior Open. He is the NBC and Golf Channel TV analyst. Peter, I appreciate you joining us. What makes this course so spectacular?
Oh, it's one of the iconic golf courses in the world, in my opinion. But it's really hard to make your way around here. You can never conquer Shinnecock Hills. You can only hope to manage your scores out there. And right now the scores are way over par. It's windy. It's a beautiful day. There's not a cloud in the sky, but the wind really adds a difficult factor that is going to cause problems with a lot of players.
And for people who watch this on television, you mentioned the wind. I think that's always hard to judge a little bit. You can see maybe the trees moving. But what else about this? The topography is pretty challenging as well. Sometimes you don't get a sense for the course very well watching it on television. What do you see from the ground that maybe you don't see from the television?
What you see from the ground are subtle elevation changes. A lot of fairways go up and down. It's a links golf course. We're not a true links in the sense that we're on a body of water. We're near body of water here out on Long Island, but if you miss a fairway here, you're in this heavy gorse, and there's really no chance to make par. So you're going to have to manage your game. You're going to have so many opportunities to just save par. Bubba Watson just made a double bogey on the second hole, and Jordan Spieth, I think, is four over early in his round. So it's just causing these problems, so many problems for these guys.
We talked to Brant Snedeker on the show yesterday. He said he thought that there was likely a chance that the winner of this U.S. Open, given how challenging this course could be outside of red numbers. In other words, it could be somebody over par or somebody very close to par. What kind of number do you think wins this tournament this weekend?
I think Brant is exactly correct. I know in the past, I think Raymond Floyd won here in 86 when I played. He was one under. And when Corey Pavin won in 95, the other time I played here at Shinnecock Hills in the Open, I think he was even. So I think I don't think we'll see a score in under par. I think we're going to see an even par or over par winner come Sunday.
That's amazing for a lot of people because we haven't seen that in so long. And it also means par is a really good score. So if you are watching this golf tournament at home, and you are expecting to be seeing birdies, you should be watching for pars instead and understanding that that's a good score on just about every hole here.
Yeah, I think the U.S. Open's probably the most defensive tournament we play. In other words, you're always on defense. Even if you drive it in the fairway and hit the ball on the green, you're always you have to be very cautious because you never know what's coming up. I don't think you're going to see a lot of birdies on players' cards, but you are going to see a lot of bogeys, doubles, and triples because the golf course is just that difficult.
What about holes in particular that stand out to you and you look at and you say, boy, this is going to be a place where there are some massacres, where there are some big numbers that come up. You've got to be able to survive what on this course?
I would recommend everybody that's listening, pay attention to the 11th hole. It's an uphill par 3 to an elevated green with a crosswind. And when I've played here at Shinnecock Hills, I don't think I've ever hit the green in regulation because especially with wind like we have today, you have to knock the ball down going up the hill. Normally when you're going up a hill to a par 3, you want to put the ball up in the air and have some altitude on your shot, but you can't on 11 because of the wind. So keep your eye on the 11th hole. I think you're going to see some disasters there.
We're talking to Peter Jacobson. He's a 7-time PGA winner, won the 2004 U.S. Senior Open, NBC and the Golf Channel TV analyst. And you are also part of the Lexus Golf Ambassadorship as well, which has an important role here out at the tournament.
Well, one of the things that happens in the PGA Tour and really in golf around the world is corporate sponsorships. And this is Lexus's 12th year as the official vehicle of the U.S. Open and a corporate partner with the USGA. We've got over 350 vehicles here for the players and officials to get to and from the golf course, which, as anybody that travels and knows, when you rent a lot of cars, you really don't know what you're doing or where you're going. So we make it as easy as possible for the players. We give them a beautiful vehicle to get them to and from the golf course, and we always like to say it's going to be their best drive of the day.
Speaking of drives of the day, there are hours and hours of traffic out surrounding this course today. Did you ever come close to missing a tee time? You mentioned that you're in places you're not that familiar with. You're getting into a car. Maybe you go the wrong direction. Certainly in an age before everybody had GPS in their cars and on their phones. You ever come close to missing a tee time or ever have a buddy who did?
I came from the days of smoke signals. We didn't have GPS on our cell phone. It was smoke signals and a guy standing on the corner saying, go this way! Now, back in the day, we always made sure we got to the course way early. Traffic is thick at any U.S. Open. A couple years ago, we were in Philly at Marion. That was a challenge. When we're at Wingfoot down in Mamaroneck, that's a challenge. A lot of these iconic golf courses are built in neighborhoods around the country. So you've really got to map out your strategy, not only on the golf course, but also on the roads, getting to the golf course. So far, everything's been pretty good. I give kudos to the cops and the police officers that are directing traffic. There's a pretty good plan in place here to get people to and from the course.
We're talking to Peter Jacobson. Peter, when you look at the leaderboard, and I know that we've already got, like you said, Jordan Spieth starting off plus 4 30 minutes into his round. So you get a little bit of a cheat here. But who did you like coming into this tournament? A lot of guys still haven't teed off. Who do you think this court suits? What kind of names are you looking at that you anticipate having some success as much as you can, given how challenging this course is?
I took a tee sheet last night, and I circled names that I thought really had a chance to win, and I circled Dustin Johnson, defending champion Brooks Koepka, Ricky Fowler, Sergio, Rafa Cabrera-Bello from Spain, who I think has the game to win a major championship, Paul Casey, John Rahm, also from Spain. There's just so many guys. Phil Mickelson, I think, has got a great chance because of his short game. I like McIlroy, but really, I think a dark horse to keep your eye on is a young man who won a couple of weeks ago on tour, Aaron Wise, out of California, born in South Africa, went to my alma mater, University of Oregon. He won the AT&T down at Byron Nelson in Dallas. So keep your eye on him, but I think it's going to be an experienced player who wins here. I think the golf course is too hard and the pressure is too great for a first-time qualifier, somebody that is here for the first time to win.
You didn't mention him, but obviously a lot of our listeners ask about him every single time there's a golf tournament going on at all. What do you think this course will be like for Tiger Woods?
Well, the story of Tiger Woods is amazing. The fact that he's even here playing and competing again after having back fusion surgery is incredible. I've had back surgery myself, and I know how difficult it is to come back. And to see him swinging freely and moving as well as he is, I know he's been struggling with the putter. He showed up here with a couple extra putters, which is always a sign of concern when somebody shows up with extra golf clubs. But he certainly has the talent. He's won 14 major championships. It wouldn't surprise me to see him win because he's so good, but I think he's got a he's got a chance, but it's long odds.
Good stuff. I know you're a busy guy. We appreciate you, Peter Jacobson, hopping on with us. Enjoy the tournament, and thanks for talking to our audience all this morning.
You got it. Take care. Thank you.